Hey everybody, I've got the reboot of part two of our Cubism episode for you today. This episode was originally released on August 26th, 2016. One quick correction from this episode. Very late in the episode, Piet Mondrian comes up and we mistakenly call him French. He wasn't French, he was Dutch. Also, make sure to check out the Art History Babes store at arthistorybabes.com. We've got some new stickers up. And be on the lookout for an upcoming Cubism-inspired playlist on our Spotify. There's already a handful of playlists up, and I'll be getting the Cubism one out sometime this week. Enjoy the show!
The Art History Babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Jen.
I'm Ginny. And we are the Art History Babes.
Today we're doing Cubism Part 2.
Which means that we're on our like fourth bottle of wine.
Oh my god.
So if you listen to Color Theory Part 2, you have an idea of what you're in for. But here we are, talking about Cubism.
How you say
Before we get into it, let's see what's going on. Has anyone read the new Harry Potter?
No. But
what?
Wait, does anyone read her other book?
What?
No, there's a new
one. It's a big deal. It's a big deal, Jen.
The Cursed Child.
Okay, I'm going to talk about it because I'm the only one who's reading it, apparently.
Okay, but then, I have some.
Okay. I haven't finished it. I'm on like the last 20 pages.
How did you come here?
Literally would not have come until I finished.
So I'm almost done with it. It's ridiculous I haven't finished it yet. It's really interesting because it's a play. It's a play. And it's yours. So Harry Potter, the Cursed Child, it's a play. It's not...
This is serious business.
It is serious business, Jen. Did you not read? Are you not a Harry Potter fan?
I'm so sorry, you guys. I'm not. And
get out of my face.
Oh my god. I'm out of the group. You don't ever talk to me or my son ever again.
You don't believe in magic. Anyways.
Do you believe in magic?
Stop it.
I've enjoyed every second of it. It has taken me right into the Harry Potter world. I have really enjoyed it. In my humble opinion, it reminds me of just really, really, really good fan fiction.
Oh.
Yeah. It's different because it's a play for one, so it's a completely different format,
mm-hmm.
And it's a real play, and it's got some interesting stuff going on. But to say it is the seventh book is not true.
It's doing it a disservice.
Yeah, is what it exactly. Like. It's a separate thing. Okay. I think you should go into it looking at it as a separate thing. But I instantly felt like I was in the Harry Potter universe again, which is really all I would ever want out of a Harry Potter book.
Whoa. Okay, side note from the whole actual Harry Potter, but have you guys read any of J.K. Rowling's...
What was the other one? I didn't read it.
No. So there was her other book that she wrote under her name, which was Casual Vacancy.
Yeah, I didn't read
but
that.
But she also has a whole crime series written under the name Robert... I want to say it's like Robert... I don't... It's a different name. But it begins with a G. It's a fake name.
Have you read it?
Yes, I've read all three of them. I just finished the third one today.
Are they amazing?
It's fantastic. It's really? It's all about like a private detective, and his name's Corman Strike, and he's
Corman Strike.
Corman Strike.
Corman.
How do you spell that?
Corman sounds like a spice.
Caramon.
It's a British spice.
And it's a running joke in the book that everyone calls him Cameron. So, like, it's not even, like, a common name that in there.
Is that a fake name? He has a fake name. Is that what
no, it's his name. People just always get it wrong because it's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Long story short, it's a fantastic series. And there's three of them. And you guys should honestly read them if you like crime novels. But let's... Art...
Jen stole someone's wine, so we're gonna give this to Ginny.
I put it somewhere.
I stole someone's wine, I'm sorry.
Okay, so that was just a brief side note about J.K. Rowling.
Because we love you.
We do. We're gonna dive back into the world of Cubism.
Congratulations.
I hope you enjoyed our first episode where we discussed the circles of Cubism, the different types of Cubism, primitivism, and the fourth dimension. all very important aspects of Cubism and just modernism in general. So what we're going to do now is we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit. Going to pass it over to Natalie, and she's going to talk a little bit about a movement that was kind of a response to Cubism. It was alive at about the same time. What was it,
started about 1909.
1909, so it was alive
basically, really right in the middle of it.
Yeah, right after the inception of Cubism. And it was kind of a response, but they have a lot of very similar aspects, which is futurism. So futurism and Cubism, they kind of go hand in hand, but also have interesting differences. So Natalie's going to talk about that a little bit.
Natalie!
Hey, guest.
So yeah, so the futurist movement, it was based in Italy, so futurismo. Started about 1909, went through the late 1920s, and it's really on the heels of Cubism in that they share a lot of the same ideas, especially in terms of reduction and breaking things down into, breaking objects down into pieces. A lot of the similarities have to do with the idea of, like, movement. Where it starts to differ is that the Cubists were really focused on technology and machinery. So when they were dealing with movement, they were really into speed and urban modernity, and they found beauty in the machine rather than nature. And instead of taking the past and building upon it, as had kind of always been done, they thought that you had to basically destroy and deconstruct the past in order to reach a true modernity. So it was just pure destruction of everything that had come before in order to make way for the new. And it was meant to really go beyond the visual, even in terms of what we think of as, you know, traditional art. So painting, two-dimensional stuff, even sculpture. It was supposed to be multi-sensory. So you were supposed to see a painting of a car and you were supposed to kind of feel the heat and smell the oil, and you were supposed to have all of these other reactions to it other than just visual. And it was also kind of violent. They were really into, yeah, just like violence, and it was a very youthful movement. So a lot of young Italians, again, a lot to do with destruction. So that in itself is kind of a violent act.
In relation to Cubism, there are a lot of similarities here in the book I talked about in the first episode, which was Cubism and Culture by, what's his name, Antleaf. Cubism and Culture, Mark Antleaf and Patricia Layton. They actually refer, there's a quote that refers to Cubism as the end of the old world of art with a new violence.
Ooh.
So yeah, there is, in both Cubism and Futurism, a certain violence to it. It's very, like, intense, and it can be violent. Some images that you look at, some Cubist images that you look at, they have this inherent, like, sharpness and violence to them. The difference, I think, like, because also Futurists, they...
It was a social movement as well. It wasn't only an art movement. It
yeah.
was a social movement.
They also, similar to Cubists, they embodied this idea of this rejection of tradition. Obviously, they're trying to come up with a new way of looking at things, a new modernity, as Natalie was describing. What's different between the Cubists and the Futurists is that the Cubists were very attached to this idea of natural forms. They saw in, as we talked about in the first episode, we talked about how African art influenced Cubism, and they saw an attraction to the natural, to the, there was something mystical and romantic about the natural world as opposed to the civilized world.
Yeah.
So,
or even just the human aspect of that natural primitive, quote unquote primitive world. Yeah, exactly. And the Futurists were much more interested in technology. They were very into the machine. The automobile was like their muse, honestly. They talk about the automobile, the car, a lot. And in February of 1909, Filippo Tommaso Marinetti wrote the Futurist Manifesto. And a lot of that manifesto, which is written in standard manifesto form, talks about being in a car and getting into a car accident, but like in a very riveting way. It's not scary. It's exciting. Yeah. And he refers to it as his beautiful shark.
And so he's mixing these.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a very interesting.
See, okay,
read.
This reminds me of the difference between kind of your, in terms of modern day philosophy and the way people look at things. This reminds me of the difference between science fiction people, like people that look at, like, take a philosophical perspective that's more science fiction based, and then you're more like hippie nature based philosophy in modern day. You know what I mean? You have like natural forms and like attraction to quote unquote primitivism. Mm-hmm. So simpler things, nature, the natural way of things. And then you have like your science fiction people who are all about technology and robots and how that relates to humans.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of a similar divide.
Well, and you talked about in the beginning how cubism comes out of industrialization and it's a response to it. So futurism is just a response to cubism and that it's nature versus technology. And we haven't let go of that still. People still debate today which is kind of a stronger force in which we should be more invested in. And
yeah, it's like the ultimate
answer.
Yeah, it's like, exactly. It's like the ultimate debate. Like, should we let technology guide us or should we let nature guide us?
Yeah.
And like, I feel like that's a very real thing that's going on with futurism versus cubism. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the central ideas are very similar. They're both guided by this desire to reject traditional ideas, come up with new ideas, mm-hmm. look at the world from a new place. But cubism is looking at it from this more like going backward and finding the answers, where futurism is looking forward to technology for the answers.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, some of the stances they take in their manifesto, I mean, they talk about a love for danger and fearlessness. It's a very youthful,
what badasses.
Yeah, it is. There's so much angst in these words, you guys. It's insane. Okay, so let's see. Right here, we affirm that the world's magnificence has been enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of speed, a racing car whose hood is adorned with great pipes like serpents of explosive breath. A roaring car that seems to ride on the grape shot is more beautiful than the victory of Samarith.
Yes.
I don't know what that means.
What?
Yes. Yeah, like they are like getting off to technology.
I am.
I feel like, I don't know, I get like a self-destructive vibe a little bit. I mean, that could just be me.
Well, that's what I mean, like, it is very like full of youth and angst. Like they have this kind
We're gonna
like,
live forever!
Yes, totally. They're on that roll. It's kind of interesting though, because I feel like the manifesto is a lot more in that vein than the art comes off.
Yeah. Like, the art is similar to cubism.
It's very similar to cubism.
The art, like, the mentality is both similar and different in very extreme ways, but the art blends together sometimes. Like, there are certain futurist paintings that look a lot like cubist paintings.
Yeah, it's pretty much subject matter that kind of really differentiates the two. You get a lot more, surprise, surprise, cars, other mechanical objects in futurism, but you still see those in cubism. They're just more present in futurism.
Yeah.
So, like, statistically, you see more of them in futurism, but it's not that different.
Yeah.
It's really the manifesto, the whole theory behind it.
Which kind of brings up an important point about cubism that I meant to mention earlier, but, like, when you look at a cubist painting, if you're totally unfamiliar with what's going on with modern art or any of those things, and you look at it, oftentimes people are very confused by it. Even today, it gets a bad rap. Like, even today, people might look at a Picasso and be like, what the fuck is going on?
Like, what was he thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Now, the thing is with cubism that's important to remember is, like, there's all these ideas at work here. Oh, God, don't point that at us. What are you doing? Oh my God.
That's so phallic, Jen.
Phallic symbols all over the place. Oh. Okay, so, but cubism, you should put that on our Instagram.
Oh, I didn't get it for Instagram. That's on Snapchat.
You can save it. You can put it on Instagram.
Let me see it right now.
But yeah, so you look at a cubist painting,
and you, if you have no art historical background, no, even no understanding of modern art, you might look at it and be really confused and wonder what the hell is going on. But what's important to remember is Cubism is intended to be an expression of reality. They look at something real, like a cat, and then they try and look at it from multiple angles or multiple dimensions, as Jen was talking about. And they try to put it all into one picture plane. So you begin to understand that when you look at something that is in reality, you look at it from your own combination of perspectives. You look at it from what, if you look at a cat, you're going to see that cat from whatever angles you have seen a cat before. Well,
what's up with that cat, though?
There's some important Cubist paintings of cats.
I've seen cats from every angle.
But, like, that's kind of the idea, is it's meant to mess with your perception, because it's essentially suggesting this idea that here is this image that is something that you know you have seen in reality, but it's playing with your senses, and it's saying, but you will only see it from the perspectives you have seen it from. So it gets...
One at a time. But we're going to give them all to you at once.
We're going to give you all these perspectives, and you're still, as you look at this painting of this thing from multiple perspectives, you're only going to recognize it from the perspectives you have seen before. So it's like a... I'm fucking with your perspective, essentially, which I think is the main thing, the number one visual trick that both cubists and futurists do.
Yeah. So I want to love the futurists because they're Italian and I want to. But the manifesto, let's go back to the term problematic. It has its issues. You get down to the end, and they save it for numbers 9 and 10 because, you know, they don't want to lose face right at the beginning. So, number 9, we will glorify war, the world's only hygiene. Militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of freedom bringers. Beautiful ideas worth dying for, and scorn for women. Why? Why did you have to add that last
woman.
Line?
Woman.
Yeah, not women. Woman. Yeah, like, so unnecessary. Anyways. Okay, and then number 10. We will destroy the museums, libraries, academies of every kind. We'll fight moralism, feminism, every opportunistic or utilitarian cowardice. So they went, I mean...
No, they won't.
So
no, they
much
won't.
Sense that this is what led into Mussolini and the fascists.
Yeah. These guys went fascist fast.
Yeah. I don't even think we really need to pick that apart. That's like,
fuck you guys.
Glad you failed.
From a visual perspective, I can appreciate it in the ways that it's similar to cubism and messes with perspective. And I also dig the whole technology aspect of things, because technology is dope and interesting. But it gets really self-gratifying really quick.
And they start to treat it like cars, which I guess kind of carries over to nowadays, but like, cars and technology and machinery is super masculine.
Cars are manly.
Yeah, and that has, you know, is like the antithesis to women. I don't know where that really came from.
Me
but
either.
It came out of nowhere. It's kind of disappointing. I'm really disappointed in you, Marinetti. But, you know, yeah, they went full-blown fascist. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that they're the only avant-garde movement to ever be right-wing. I think.
I don't know that you're wrong, but I would agree with that. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're very, like, they had some good ideas, and then they just went a really weird direction with it.
Yeah.
A really intolerant, shitty direction, unfortunately.
So we'll put some examples of futurist art on the website. I'll just list some influential artists because I don't want to just, like, rip on it and then not mention some big names. So we have Umberto Boccioni, Giacomo Balla, Gino Salvemi, and Carlo Prada. Those are just some of the many futurist artists. And it didn't only stay in Italy. It actually moved over to Russia and England and some other locations later on. But biggest in Italy, started in Italy. Most well-known for being Italian.
Yeah, it's typically referred to as Italian futurism.
Yeah.
And yeah, once again, it does play with some really interesting ideas, so it's not totally lost, but Once you start rejecting.
To lose the misogyny.
Yeah.
Not necessary.
Once you start pulling out misogyny like that, I'm kind of over you. So, yeah, that's futurism as kind of a response and a conversation with cubism. Yeah, we'll have a few images so you can kind of see the similarities and the differences. Now, to jump off of that and go a completely different direction, Ginny.
There's no transition there possible. Isn't.
Ginny's going to talk about a badass female cubist that,
defied the futurists.
Yeah, defied those futurists. Fuck yeah. You, futurists.
Oh, they were so terrible. Oh, God. Okay, so, you know, cubism is not, like, my realm per se. So I was like racking my brains. I was like, okay, what could I contribute to this episode? Like, come on, Ginny, think of something. And then I was like, oh my God, Blanche.
Lady power.
Blanche LaZelle. Many of you probably don't know who Blanche is. I did not know who Blanche was for a very long time. But she can easily be credited as one of the first women artists to introduce modern art to America, which is like a really big deal. And Blanche was actually part of the Provincetown Printers, which was a group of female artists, primarily printmakers. They also, a lot of them were also painters, kind of branched into other mediums outside of just printmaking. But the Provincetown Printers were woodblock, like they were a woodblock. Jesus. Okay. They were a woodblock print society in America. And they were founded in 1918. And so Blanche's kind of role in this is that, you know, she was, we'll just start with kind of her background first. She was born in 1878 in America, and due to a childhood illness, she was pretty much deaf. But despite that, she went out and she went to college, and then she went to art school, and later she went to Paris, where she took a lot of art courses and was trained under various artists in Paris at the time. She was even a classmate at one point with Georgia O'Keeffe. So she has like a really prolific, impressive background from a young age. And she studied under a variety of Cubist French artists, including Fernand Léger, André Lhote. Okay, so here's the thing. I haven't taken French. It's bad. I probably should have. But I haven't. So most of these, I'm like just kind of winging it. Albert Gleize. Albert Gleize.
There it is.
Albert Gleize was one of the first to publish a major treatise on cubism in 1912, which is just called Du Cubisme. Which just basically means on cubism. And that was in 1912. Maybe I already said that, but I can't remember because honestly, we've been recording for a long time. And I don't know anymore. Anyways, so this was Blanche's background where she was educated in many ways, both academically and also kind of like in the field where she was in Paris and she was learning from like the top cubist artists of the time. And so naturally, when she comes back to the States, she's bringing a lot of this style and influence back to America. So she was, like I said, primarily a printmaker where she was working with other women artists in the Provincetown Printers workshop. But she also did paintings, and both her prints and her paintings really drew influence from her cubist teachers in Paris. And this, you can see it in kind of like these angled patchwork lines and sort of geometric forms and these elevated vantage points. And so she is, you know, really integral in like bringing this style back to America following like World War I and when a lot of like expatriates are coming back to the States. She was also really influenced by ukiyo-e woodblock prints, or which are Japanese woodblock prints. And this,
she's also very integral in bringing kind of like the Japanese Mei print aesthetic to the States. And
bless her for that.
Yeah, she's just like a really cool lady.
Yeah, not to mention, like, I didn't know anything about her until you brought her up to me, and mm-hmm. I like looked her up briefly. And her work is fucking dope.
Oh,
like,
it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. It's so great.
I know. I saw a print for her recently that was like for $5,000. And I was like, well, I'll just simply set aside money for multiple, multiple years. And then I'll just purchase it. And it'll be great.
Yeah, but it would be swell. Yeah. About a Bob Dylan painting recently.
But we'll post some of her prints and at least one of her paintings kind of parallel to some of these Cubist male artists in France that she studied under. And you'll see kind of the visual connections that she had with them. And like the Provincetown printers, like we could do an episode on them alone. They were so cool.
We have to do
so cool.
We have so many episodes to do.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
We have to do a lot of printmaking episodes. There's so many ridiculously talented printmakers that aren't fake. And like aren't famous to laymen.
Right. And like, printmakers are often overlooked in art history, which
is a shame because it's a prints shame. Are amazing.
It's a shame. So Blanche, this is for you.
You're an art history babe.
I hope I did you a solid here. I hope that I made you proud.
Makes no sense. Moment of silence or Blanche.
Moment of silence.
Blanche!
Yeah, so she's our featured art history babe of the episode. Yeah, you should all check her out because...
And we'll post sources for this because there's a really excellent book specifically on Blanche that I referenced for this.
She has great colors, too.
I know.
She's like a really great combination of cubism and fauvism.
Yes.
And I'm obsessed with
and
fauvism.
And she was very influenced by both of them.
Yeah. Her shit's gorgeous. Like, we'll definitely post it. She's amazing.
And it's definitely synthetic cubism if we're going back to... Yeah, it's definitely synthetic cubism if we're going back to the two types. She uses a lot of color. Mm. And kind of simplified shapes rather than focusing on movement.
But yeah.
It is very, very aesthetic.
She's dope.
Stuff.
Yeah, I love it. It makes me, like, really happy.
I know.
Like, it's like a happy feel. So I think that's what...
Is that it?
That we got for Cubism Part 2? Anyone else have anything left to say on Cubism before we go to listener mail?
No.
Any?
No.
Well, Jen's
That's
checked
a hard
out.
No from Jen.
Any favorite Cubist artist?
We've been here all night long.
We
to
never
quote
talked
Lionel
about
Richie.
Mondrian.
Well, he's not technically Cubist. Right? He was influenced by Cubist.
I don't even know.
Pete Mondrian came out of Cubism. I think. I don't know. He's kind of a mix of both. He was. Undeniably influenced by Cubists, and
That's true, though. You're right. It is way more minimalist.
Yeah, but then he kind of moved towards minimalism.
I moved down the French rabbit hole.
Yeah, he's French, and
the
he...
The French rabbit hole.
He's French.
That should be a restaurant name.
Sounds really sexual to me.
Or a band name. The French rabbit hole.
Ooh, sounds so sexual to me. Like, just not nice.
No, I don't know. I associate
I
anything...
I think it is nice, because it's... It's an enigma.
I love enigmas.
No. It sounds like something you would look up on Urban Dictionary.
That's true.
Guys, have you looked up a French rabbit?
Oh, dude.
Right?
We can make that happen
a thing.
Now.
What do we want French rabbit hole
listeners
to
write in to what you think of
so
French rabbit.
Oh, my God. Okay, guys. Okay. This is a Twitter moment. This is a Twitter moment. Okay, if you're listening right now, hashtag French rabbit hole and what you think the definition should be.
And if it's too crude, email it to us. We'll still read
it. If it's too crude, you should just probably put it on Twitter. but hashtag it. Let's see what we can make happen.
This is so great. I'm
this
so
is fun.
Thrilled about
so,
this.
Yeah, that's the new hashtag. We'll all be thinking about it. French rabbit hole. See what you can come up with. Yeah. Listener mail. Time for listener mail. So let's pull up some listener mail.
Okay.
Do you want to read it, Jen?
Yeah, certainly.
Do you want me to read it? I'll read it.
Jen wants to read it.
I want to read it.
Okay, let's let Jen read it.
Let me read it.
First, we're just going to say this Cubist episode was partially inspired by Megan's email because she had requested kind of like specific art period episodes. So, Megan, thank you.
Thank you, Megan.
Now,
the email, the header is thank you in all caps.
No, thank you, Megan.
No, this is Carla. But thank you, Megan.
This is Carla, oh, but Carla. Also thank you, Carla. Megan, but this is from Carla. Hi! You gals are my saviors. I was so glad when I found your podcast, since you make art history detailed, accessible, and interesting. Unlike the other art history podcasts I listen to. Girl. Okay, so I'm 17 and from Melbourne, Australia, and I am super keen to do art history at university. So I was
super keen is like the so fucking keen. Cutest.
I know.
We need to go to Australia because I really want to meet Carla.
I love Carla so much. Carla, you're super keen to do art history at university. But you were just wondering if we had any tips for studying art history at uni and if you have any idea what types of jobs you'll have when you finish grad school.
Fuck.
I know art history leads to curating, but I was wondering what else can lend itself to. Baby, I want to know too. I want to know too.
Jen has just called you baby like 3 times, which is a true honor. I hope you know
that's
this, Carla.
Because I love you, and I really, I love women. They're like my babies. You guys are my babies. All right, the last part of Carla's email says, also, there are so many art books in the world, but could you recommend any that, one, give a non-boring but detailed overview of art history, in parentheses, or at least of the 20th century or something, and number two, are easy for a smart but not genius 17-year-old to read? And the end of the email says, thank you, and please, please, please keep making episodes. Love, Carla. P.S. It would be cool if you maybe did an episode explaining all the symbolism in a really complex painting like something from the Renaissance. P.P.S. Yeah. Thank you for recommending that 20th century in color book because it's fulfilling my life. Carla, thank you.
Sweet.
Oh, Carla, you little sweet baby.
So I want to start off by saying, though, Carla, do not discredit yourself. You sound very intelligent, so we are not going to give you any dummy books. You sound like you can handle any art historical texts with the best of them.
For sure. And we're all grad students here, and I can guarantee 100%. We had a read shit last year that we were like, what's happening? Like,
yeah.
We had no idea. And the only way to figure it out is to read it. So,
and to talk about it. Read and talk.
Yeah.
Talk and read.
Read and talk. Exactly. So if you find something that you find is too difficult, I would say don't give up on it. I'm sure you can figure it out. You can totally do it. Also, the Pantone book she was referring to is from our color theory episode. I'm glad you enjoyed it because we all love the shit out of it.
Right.
It's a great book. It's just really fun and really interesting. But we have some books for you. I think we all have some book recommendations that we can give you. Also, before we get into the book recommendations, though, I do want to kind of mention that, like, being a young art historian can be discouraging. Stick with it. Don't let anyone, like, discourage you from it. Like, stick with it. As far as, like, jobs go and stuff, we're still figuring that out, but obviously we're kind of trying to just, like, make it our own thing. We're doing a podcast. Like, just do what you love and you figure out a way to do it. So,
and also people who are like, you're that major, like, I hated that class, or how are you gonna make money? Fuck them. Honestly,
it's more often than not, people are like, I took an art history class and I loved it. Like, I get a lot of that.
Yeah.
Don't you guys? Like, some people will be like,
yeah,
like business people or just, you know,
right.
Way different.
I think
majors
the older
get
you
some,
get, the more
people have a negative experience.
I think the more understanding people are and like the less judgmental people are. Like, as a practice, I think it's just in poor taste to like hear about something that someone is studying or doing as a profession, be like, oh God, because There are people are so fucking different. And yeah. that is what is great about humanity. And that, like, each and every field there is in the world, and there are a plethora, needs to have people that are into it.
100%. And
being able to appreciate that, being able to be like, oh, like, that's what you're into? I know nothing about that. Or, oh, I took a class in that, and I got, like, a fucking D plus. I don't know if they have D pluses in Australia, but it's, like, a bad grade. but just being able to recognize that people have their areas, and that is a good thing, and that the world needs that.
100%. Yeah, I think that's, like, that was beautifully put and so important. And just, yeah, the idea that any profession or any discipline is lesser than the other is silly. I don't know. I'm just, like, a big believer in the idea that, like, do what you love. Like, yeah. do it full force. And no matter what it is, it could be anything in the world. But if you do it full force,
you'll,
like,
be fine.
Yeah. It might be a romantic idea, but I think it's a
I think so, too.
It's a true romantic idea. Yeah. If you do it with, like, your heart and you, like, really put yourself into it, people will notice and they'll say, hey, it's cool that this person loves this thing and is doing this thing, and you'll be fine. It's way better to go into something that you think maybe isn't the most practical thing, but do it with all your heart, than to go into a practical profession that you don't love. Because people notice when people love what they do. And people love when they see people loving what they do. I think that's a human thing, and it's something we love to see. So if this is what you love, we 100% encourage you to do it and do it full force, and you will be fine. Just trust that you will be fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, books. Yes, for book recommendation. And that was also a general statement to other people that are looking to go into art history.
Or any field that they feel discouraged out of.
Which, unfortunately, at this point in history, the arts, I feel like, are kind of on that. So if you're going into any type of, like, arts thing, and you feel humanities, you feel discouraged, like, stick with it, love it, and make it yours. But we have some book recommendations for you.
These books, Carla, are coming from the collection of Ginny, so they are very limited. But I was thinking, because you had said, like, 20th century, which is a little tricky for me, at least.
Give her what you've got, because I have a 20th century.
This is great. This is great, because we're recording in my house, and I am, like, more of, like, the 17th, 18th century, and even sometimes 16th century person. But if you ever want to read about, like, the destruction of art, whether it be in, like, wartime or revolution, a really good book is The Destruction of Art, Iconoclasm and Vandalism Since the French Revolution. So that's like kind of close to the 20s. I mean, it certainly spans into the 20th century. And this is by Dario Gamboni. Totalitarian Art by Igor Golemstock. And this just talks about art during, like, totalitarian rule, which is certainly, like, 20th century onward. The Art of Forgery by Noah Charney is a pretty fresh book, and it's by Noah Charney. Like, he just really figured it out. Like, he's publishing with Phaidon, which, like, you're making some money that way.
That's how you make money, Carla.
Yeah. Carla, if you're really worried about making money, just, like, get in with Phaidon. You'll be okay. But, The Art of Forgery is a fascinating read, and it's just about all of the art forgers, really spanning from, like, a great duration of time, from, like, kind of the 14th century or 15th century onward to now. So that is certainly a good read. And that's all I've got. So, Dunkershane, good night.
We got a couple more. Okay, so my textbook that I had from undergraduate modern art, I think it's pretty solid. It's a pretty solid text. Yeah. It's History of Modern Art by H.H. Arneson and Elizabeth C. Mansfield. And really, honestly, so many of, like, our episodes are so many of the subjects I've even done, like, research papers on, I've consulted this text. It's just kind of got everything you want in terms of modernism. Like a good resource. Yeah, it's an amazing...
It may not be, like, a, like, something you reference in a paper, but it gives you, like...
Yeah, and it's just, like, If you have something in modernism that you get into or interested in, it's a great book to go to. And it just, like, every time I've looked at it, it sent me in really, really great directions. So that's just a good base text. And I think Natalie's got some ideas.
Just based on some research I've done in the last year, two that stood out to me, depending on where your interests lie, if you look at getting outside of Western art, Contemporary Iranian Art by Taleen Grigor is a very, very well-written book, and it covers Iranian art. It's the first to really cover art since the revolution in, like, a really transparent way, and it's just fascinating. Yeah, so that's one of my high recommendations. And then also 9.5 Theses on Art in Class by Ben Davis is a great read. It just delves into ideas on, again, art in class, so different class hierarchies. It's broken up by chapter and topic, so you don't feel overwhelmed. Each chapter can kind of be read individually. And there's an actual essay called, they're basically individual essays, and one is called 9.5 Theses on Art in Class. That's where the title of the entire book comes from. He's a very well-known art critic. And that's 20th and 21st century. That delves a little more into 21st century, but.
And then one more that I know a few of us have read. If you're interested in curation at all, or gallery setup.
The White
Cube. Yes. Inside
the White Cube.
Inside the White Cube. I can't think of the author's name, but just look it up.
Look it up. No, okay. I know him. He's great.
Natalie's looking it up. But Inside the White Cube, it's actually written by an artist, believe in the 70s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. But it essentially talks about gallery space and kind of the reimagining of gallery space. And it's a really interesting read when you think about exhibition and gallery work.
Brian O'Doherty.
Yeah.
O'Doherty. I feel like I'm saying that wrong.
O'Doherty. That's right. Okay. It's an easy read and it's really interesting and I really loved it. I actually have been meaning to go back and read it again.
Yeah.
It's really great. So check that one out. So that, I think we gave you
a lot of books.
We gave you your reading homework.
We love books.
Yeah. So yeah, there's your homework.
Children love the books.
Children love the books. But yes, thank you all so much again for your emails. And we got like so many sweet emails. And like Jessica's email, we're gonna respond to you by type. By type font.
By pigeon.
By pigeon carrier.
By smoke signal. But yeah, we've gotten so many great emails and we've gotten so many great shout outs on different social media platforms. And I promise you, we appreciate every single one of them.
We do.
We geek out
on
them.
We read them all. We share them all.
Yeah, we like get
like,
excited.
Hey, did you guys have a shitty day? Well, read this. It'll make you feel better.
it's amazing. So we appreciate every little bit of support we've gotten. Obviously, if you want to show us any love on any social media platform, we love every minute of it. If you want to email us, our email address is arthistorybabes@gmail.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. You can like us. If you really want to help us out and help us kind of get more like recognition, you can write a review for us on iTunes. Get kind of a conversation going there. That's how we get noticed in the podcast world, I guess. So yeah, anything you want to do, like really,
tell your friends.
Oh, we're on Tumblr too.
Tell your mom. Tell your dad.
Don't tell hide your, them.
Tell your cousins. Jesus.
Hide your mom.
No. Hide your mom with the podcast.
Hide your mom and then give her this podcast. Thank you so much for just giving, like, supporting us in this fun little endeavor. We're having so much fun doing this.
To our drunken rants.
Yeah, and the fact that you're enjoying it is just unbelievably wonderful. And we really appreciate it, and we love all of you, and hopefully you'll keep listening. If you have any requests, email us. We're doing our best to keep up with them. We really appreciate them.
Oh, yeah, we are doing our best. I can't even describe the logic of
next week's architecture.
Oh my god. Tonight. Okay, so thank you for listening to our second part of our two-parter on cubism. As Jenny said, we're doing our best.
Oh my god.
And our next episode is going to be on architecture and power. So it should be pretty interesting. We're going to be talking about Mussolini. We're going to be talking about
Le Corbusier.
Le Corbusier.
And all kinds of other shit.
Yeah, and it's going to be a good one. So thank you again
Why
for
the
listening.
White House looks like it does.
Okay. We're trying our best. Oh my god.
Bye.
Bye.
We are History Babes.
Phallic symbols all over the place. Oh!
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.